Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. We are still working hard on all the regular episodes, but on the night from 7th to 8th of February, something so weird happened that I just have to speak about it. It's a tragic event, but it makes you think. So this episode will be dedicated to explaining what exactly happened in Syria from 7th to 8th, and why did it happen. So, let's start with the what part first. You see, in Syria, there are these control zones near the Euphrates River. In one of these zones, there were Kurdish Democratic Forces together with their American instructors. And apparently, there were some Bashar Assad's forces supported by Russians who decided that, hey, the Kurdish people and the Americans are sitting on a oil factory. So, they started massing up their forces because they had decided that, hey, in our zone we don't really have any oil, so let's just, you know, make a quick one, sort of a grab bag of things, and run over and, you know, take this stuff away from the Americans. The intelligence obviously noticed what was going on, because there was a massive kind of concentration of forces about 80 kilometers southeast from Deir az-Zor, the city, which is the closest there. So the Kurdish general Hassan, through his intelligence, notices that a large amount of troops, which according to him include Russian troops, come to attack their positions. Well, that's not very nice, as you can understand. So Mr. Hassan, which is commander there, he calls his Russian counterparts, his contact in the Russian military, which is kind of situated nearby, and he asks, hey, you know, that's kind of weird thing that you're doing. Why are you moving in our territory? Because we're not at war. And the Russian counterpart responds that, hey, there are no Russians here. We totally weren't here at all. Then the American instructors and officers and some technical personnel also start calling to the Russian side. And they also say, hey, are you sure that, you know, you're not coming towards us with all this? Because, you know, we don't really want to fight you, because we have ISIS to fight and there are things to do. And after all, you know, this is kind of not nice what's going on here. Again, after many failed calls, there's a one nice final call, where, again, it has been approved that, indeed, in these attacking forces who are now advancing en masse with tanks and support artillery towards the Kurdish and the American positions, the Russians officially declare that, no, we don't know what's going on there, there are no Russians there at all. And, you know, in fact, this is kind of true, because Putin had declared a couple of weeks ago that, yep, you know, ISIS in Syria is done, we have won, all the mission objectives have been completed, let's just gather all our troops and get them home. Even after that, you know, there was a bomber who got struck down in Syria, even though, you know, neither ISIS nor the bomber were supposed to be there, according to Mr. Putin. But, you know, there are completely no Russians in this formation, and he does not know anything about it. You know, that's the official Russian position. And so, in the words of many Russian commentators, apparently Americans must have said, well, if there are no Russians there, then, you know, there will be no Russians there. So what happened later was that this column of advancing tanks, it advanced towards the positions of Kurdish and American people, and they drove in two large groups, of which they had support artillery in the back, and they had like about 10 to 20 tanks. So they drive in two columns, this is about size of two battalions, and when the first battalion advances, the Kurdish forces take a position of retreat. They retreat back a bit. So then the commanders there, Russian commanders, mind you, decide to basically advance further on, and so they start forming this attack line. There's a squad moved forward, and then the second reserve battalion also comes in. You know, everything seems to be going nice. And according to reports, that is also when some of the Russians kind of noticed that, hey, Americans have just in that their base of operations, which is this oil factory, yeah, they've raised the American flag too. As, you know, that's another means of preventing what's gonna happen next. But they don't care about this situation at all. So then, just in a few moments after that, everything's blown up to bits and pieces, totally destroyed. There are American airstrikes, American drones with automated rocket artillery take out all the support artillery that's going on there. Everything's bombarded and blasted away completely. Then Apache helicopters arrive to shoot down in the middle of the night there. Because the advancing forces thought that, you know, under the guise of night, they will, you know, they will not be shot at, and it will be hard to see for them. They didn't think about thermic visors, apparently. Basically, everything's bombed, and then the Apaches arrive, and they start treating these weird terrorists as terrorists, so they start hunting down any bombardment survivors with Apache helicopters. At the end, we have, like, with F-22 Raptors and everything, they just make sure that everything's pulverized. Total losses include about 90% of all the vehicles, because out of the 10 tanks, only one did not burn completely, and all the support artillery was totally destroyed, and up to 70% of the whole personnel also get killed. And, you know, it's kind of weird, because no one takes responsibility for this, up until 15 minutes into this attack. The Russian general, whom Hassan had called before, apparently calls back and says, hey, could you please stop bombing us? We need to take out our dead and our wounded. That's where the weirdness comes in, because 15 minutes ago, everyone was completely assured that, you know, there are no Russians there. And yeah, there are many, many reports about casualties, and they vary a lot, but currently the amount of Russian soldiers dead, and this attack varies from 215 to 645. And apparently the 200 were only in kind of the first group, and the rest were in the second reserve battalion. Because it's a whole mess, because a lot of them just cannot be recognized, because they have been literally pulverized into a fine red mist. And the weirdest thing is that we also have, like, reports from them, which I have translated for you, to which I'll give you some captured, overheard on the airwaves reports from the Russian soldiers there, who, according to every source imaginable, were members of one ЧВК Wagner, which is Private Warfare Company, which are illegal in Russia, mind you, Private Warfare Company Wagner. Those guys would be the 215 in the first wave, the elite forces, and I'll explain what and how Wagner operates when we get to the Y part. And the other ones, the ones that make the difference between the 200 and the 600, apparently, are just volunteers gathered and recruited from Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, which is also fun. But yeah, I will now read you the reports from the Russian mercenaries who were there, and of whom a lot of them died. Oh yeah, and those who didn't die, apparently, according to the reports on the ground, most of them are completely out. They have terrible wounds, most of them have lost limbs, there are terrible scars, head wounds, everything. Basically, Americans decided to use overwhelming strength in response to direct threat to them and the lives of their personnel and their allies. Which, in turn, has created a massive shock in Russia, because at first they even denied that this has happened, even though, even in the face of overwhelming evidence, but now some reports by the Russian government are being stated that, that you know, there might be 5 dead or 10 dead, but that's also how they reported in the Afghanistan war and in Chechnya, and everyone who knows anything about it know that the Russian government's official reports about losses need to be, you know, usually they need to be increased by about the tenfold, maybe 20-fold even. So yeah, I will now allow the mercenaries to speak for themselves. Okay, so these are the captured recorded calls from those who participated in this combat, who were reporting back home, or just from their friends who were in contact giving calls. Not exactly sure, but these recordings spread mostly by the family members of those who died there, or their comrades, or their friends, whatever. They have been circulating the Russian language internet for a few days now since the incident. Now, they contain a lot of swear words, and I have translated them in the spirit of what these guys are relaying, instead of word for word, because I wanted to give you the feel on the ground, the whole feel of the whole situation, and not just the dry accounts. But this obviously makes it explicit and thus not family friendly. We have 3 calls here. In short, they fucked our guys to hell and back. In one company, fucking 200 people instantly dead. 200 fucking all at once. In another one, 10 guys, and I don't know about the third, but they also were hit very heavily. In short, you get it, 3 companies were hit. There were pindosi, which is a derogatory slang term for Americans used by the Russians, and they, in the beginning, started to fuck us up with the artillery, and then raised 4 fucking helicopters and turned them into a roundabout. Blasted, in short, from a large caliber fucking machine guns, which were blasting holes in everyone. But our guys, besides the assault rifles, didn't have anything fucking at all, not even talking about any RPGs or whatever. In short, we got obliterated. The Americans created the hell for us, and they concretely and totally knew that those were us, you know, that we Russians are going to capture the fuel factory. But they were, in short, you know, sitting in that factory, so we got screwed really hard. It's impossible to even think about this properly. I called the guys, we're gonna get drunk now, and, you know, there are a lot of ton of guys who are missing in action as well. Fuck it. In short, polny pizdets, complete fuckery, yet another humiliation. In short, over there nobody's taking us into account, taking us seriously. These guys, they treated us like devils, and our fucking government will just quickly and silently pull it into reverse, and no one will do anything, and there will be no responses, we won't do anything, no one will get destroyed or revenged, but instead we have all these fucking losses. So then there's voice too, the kind of the second one. Brother, watch now. There are 177 dead, and that's only the 5th company. 2nd was kinda okay. In short, the 5th got completely screwed over. They were bombed by the aviation, the copters, artillery, and Kurds with Americans just basically shat on them. The guys didn't stand a chance. Almost everyone for the 5th is dead. The remaining are in extremely heavy condition. Tonight the Tulpan will come at night tonight, and then we'll meet some who survived. Okay, goodbye. Our Viktorovich, as I think, is also in the negatives. Tulpan is the nickname for the 2 transport airplane. And then the third one. In short, the guys are calling back now. They had gone to form a column that didn't drive to them about 300 meters, fuck 700 to the positions. One squad went forward, but these, the column, they were standing. They didn't drive 300 meters. Those bastards raised the American flag and started blasting us to hell. And then helicopters took flight and started shooting everyone. Now the guy's called back. In total, it seems like 215 people. Our cargo 200 now. From the Afghanistan war, that's the terminology for the dead soldiers being transported. In short, they blasted us just off fully. Dedicated themselves. What were our guys thinking? That they would just run away in fear or give up? Fuck knows. In short, complete fuckery. Most of them can't be recognized, everything's blasted to pieces, and there is so many of them. They blasted the standing column with bombs and artillery completely. Their infantry didn't even move. From the vehicles, one tank and one artillery piece is left standing, everything else was turned into scrap in the first moments of battle. Yeah, so that's what happened. In short, there are reports now that there are hospitals in Russia with a massive amount of wounded, and like literally yesterday, according to official government reports, another 15 of these Cheveka Wagner mercenary troops got killed when they were technically guarding a munitions factory. You know, it's kind of interesting because, one, the Russian government denies that there are any regular army troops there, even though these are the same guys, the Wagnerzy, the Wagnerians, who also fought in Donetsk and Luhansk. And they still refuse to take any responsibility, they refuse to give any kind of mourning or anything, because the Russian government nicely denies that it had anything to do with the situation, you know, something random happened. And the Kurdish military leader Hassan, in this call where he described how he could call the Russians before and he didn't understand what was going on, and after this, when Dmitry Peskov, the press secretary of Putin, also had stated that, why, we don't follow what our citizens are doing in other places, it's just random. And then he said, well, it's kind of weird that I got called and told that no one was there, then that other call to kind of gather the dead bodies. Kind of silly that a superpower doesn't know what his army is doing. Now, it's a tragic situation, but it's really important because, for now, at least, Putin, I don't know when you're listening to this, but upon the moment of recording, Putin is officially ill. Apparently, there are reports that he has flu, so he hasn't even commented on this whole situation yet. But yeah, like I said, only now, and it's been a few days now, only now they even start talking about this, which also goes completely against what they've said before. So what's going on in Russian government is a bit crazy about all this insane massacre. So this is what happened, and then the Russians gathered their forces and went back. But now, obviously, this raises a few questions, like, who are these Cheveka Wagner guys, why they were there, what they were doing there, what was the intention, and why this happened. Why Russians, together with their Bashar Assad forces, decided to attack the Kurds, why they were going for this fuel factory when they got, like, called back and bombed by the Americans. Let's start with what Cheveka Wagner is, because all this also includes the answers of all the whys. In short, Wagner is the personal private army of one Yevgeny Prigozhin, also known as the cook of Putin. It's private only insofar as it's gonna get registered, because they are now making laws about these private military organizations, but they're technically very illegal, and as we have heard from their actions and reports in Luhansk and Donetsk, they're only private insofar as they have been all made up from military personnel who's on contracts, you know, because Russia has conscription. But after that, you can stay on and, you know, sign a contract. And, you know, there are some parts of the Russian army that are kind of professional. So all these guys in Wagner are basically guys who were in the Russian military 3-2-1 day ago. They're all very recent kind of turnarounds from there. So, you know, they just come out from the army and stuff. And their modus operandi is that even though private military organizations are not allowed to participate in direct combat actions according to international law, these guys ignore this fact completely. They are basically, whenever they do any missions or whatever, they are told to remove their tags, remove their passports, remove any identification that they have, and wear the uniforms of the side whom they're helping out. In this case, they were all dressed up as Bashar Assad's controlled Syrian governmental forces. Previously, they had dressed up as forces of Luhansk, Donetsk, you know, all around. But why would a cook have an army? I don't know, this is interesting, because Mr. Rogozhin, He's an interesting person. And his story starts in 2001, when he personally was serving Putin in a restaurant. And, he made friends with Mr. Putin. And then later on, as was written about in Russian Forbes, he became court fool, in a way. Then he started organizing kind of Putin's birthday parties. That, at this point, is the key difference between success stories in cinema and how that happens in Russia. This Rogozin guy, he didn't invent anything, he didn't, like, find secret treasure, he didn't win in the Olympic Games, he basically got a reward for serving the Putin's president well, as, you know, tips. Basically, he was told that he can completely, freely, and without punishment, do corruption. And, here we go. Here his story basically happens, because in 2003, Prigozhin organized a banquet in the honor of Putin's birthday. In 2008, Prigozhin's private company already at this point were the guys serving the Medvedev's inauguration ceremony. Then, in 2010, he got the contract to serve food to the Russian military. In 2011, he got a contract to provide food for all the public schools in Moscow. In 2012, he got a contract that his company will now feed every police officer, all these forces of the Ministry of Internal Affairs. Then, in 2014, he also won the contract to basically do the sanitary services for, like, cleaning services for the military installations all over Russia. In 2015, he got contracted to provide service of the apartments for, and, like, places of living in the war cities, where he also provided fuel for the stoves and fuel for the heating up and everything, and he also got contracts to build new buildings for the Ministry of Defense. And from 2016, his company also has won the contract to be the ones who got the offer to do some renovation, again, in the objects of Ministry of Defense. Interestingly enough, all these companies owned by Rogozin is just one part of these cooks' work here. As you can see, he's the Putin's friend who has been assigned to serve the military. He's been doing that forever, and all these public contests, so to speak, obviously he won all of them because he was the only one who entered. No one else got the permission, wasn't qualified. Basically, he was allowed to do complete corruption in his own way. One other thing that he's been doing is that he studied as a chemist for a while, and he kind of kept his love for chemistry. You see, whenever in Russia you hear about some random heart attack of unfriendly Putin's people, or someone being dying in a terrible accident or whatever, for the most part, that's closely to Rogozin's main line of work. See, he also runs a pharmaceutical company, who also got access to this polonium with which Litvinenko was poisoned, and yeah, he's basically treated as a poison maker of sorts as well. Russians lack money to pay their troops there, which are obviously still there. So Rogozin got promised that if he could take out oil factories, then, you know, if he does it with his own forces, then he can keep 50% of the profits, you know, help out Putin, Putin helps out you. Obviously, he couldn't do this alone and normally with regular army forces, because that would be a massive global disaster now, wouldn't it? So he used his contacts in the military to create this Wagner army. That's his own private enterprise, as it all started when he became this poisoner for Putin. So, you know, he had to have some oversights and needed some help from the army guys to make his poisons different a bit, have some specialists there, whatever. So he built up his contacts in the military, created this Wagner. In Donetsk and Luhansk, he also used his contacts to provide support to these so-called separatist republics. But yeah, Right now, he attempted in Syria to capture this fuel factory so that he could line up his pockets even more. And obviously, he didn't really give a damn crap about all these people who died there. And you might say, hey, those are mercenaries, but yes, there were also volunteers from Luhansk and Donetsk, and I believe that, and it makes total sense, because in recent news from Ukraine, it was stated that even though they're kind of on a stalemate with Ukraine, and there's not that much of a hot war going on, recently, about 2-3 weeks ago, it was stated that there's a massive mobilization effort happening in these republics. And nobody knew where these guys went or what were they supposed to do. Well, now we do know. Well, at least what's left of them. This is the saddest part, because I want to blame Russian generals and this inherent corruption of the system for all these events. Because they weren't defending any government, they weren't defending anyone's freedom. Those private forces were there because, you know, they had been speaking with Bashar Assad's government and, you know, kind of making deals with him. Just to grab some private cash for themselves, and they thought, hey, well, you know, let's take a look, maybe we could shoot the Americans and the Kurds, they must all be weak because the television says so, or something. But now to understand the soldiers. Because, again, a lot of commentators who have commented in this in Russian media, like, especially in opposition media, they themselves have served in the Russian military because they have a conscription there. And the system goes like this, because, see, in Russia, there's a massive unemployment problem. So you come back from the army, and the situation in Russia is getting tougher by the day. The people are poor. They live on practically nothing, and the economical situation is just going downhill extremely fast. But a lot of people have experience in serving in the military as they were conscripted. A lot of people have families to feed. They have mortgages to pay. And then one nice day they get a call which says, well, you know, we're gonna pay you 30,000 rubles per week. That's the average price to serve as a volunteer there. Of course, I'm not talking about the Wagner guys. Wagner guys are just contractors from the military who get transferred over there for some extra pay. But on average, it's 30,000 rubles per week. 30,000 rubles per week is 424 euros, according to today's course. Or about $400. For $400 per week, these guys go out, because that's a lot of money in Russia. And they go out to other places to grab and make millions to their corrupt guys, and they do it out of desperation and out of the fact that their propaganda constantly reports that, you know, the West is weak, nobody cares, we're gonna go there, it's gonna be totally cool, you guys. And nobody cares about their lives. At all. And that is why, you know, as this is clearly a criminal use of military force here, that is why the Russians just simply cannot admit that there is any involvement of the Russian government in this whole situation. And I can understand the American media, like Mad Dog Mattis, he also stated that, hey, we don't know whom we killed, we don't know anything about any Russians. Like, I mean, Russian government told us there was no one there, so what do we know? That's an obvious massive trolling, because I'm pretty sure Mattis and Rex Tillerson and all the other guys up there in the White House, they know exactly who went there, why did they go there. In a way, this kind of proves the point. This is how it's been described by the opposition media in Russia. This is a way of finally pushing back to Russia and not allowing them to push onwards, because This is kind of the pushback of Putin's aggression, in more ways than one. What is sad is the loss of all this life. What is not sad is the terribleness and the kind of irresponsibility of Russian military command who just refused, basically threw these guys away for nothing. Just to serve some dude's oil interests, some private guy's oil interests. He's on the Kremlin list too, Magnitsk sanctuary, like Magnitsk lists, all the sanction lists you could probably find. Yeah, this guy's there. What's gonna happen now is, previously, at least, on previous wars where Russia had participated, the wounded were not treated well. Guys who come back from Donetsk or Luhansk, they don't get any pensions, because, you know, they're not there. Их там нет, as they're told in Russia. people's lives are being ruined. They don't get any pensions. They don't get any kind of official admittance. Because, you know, they're not there. Why should we pay any pensions for the survivors there? These guys, however, are a bit more dangerous than, you know, in Donetsk and Luhansk, you can just leave the wounded soldiers who return to their own fates. But in this case, according to reports, there are about 150 people with extremely huge, dreadful wounds in the hospital. What I presume is that they'll just all gonna get killed off quietly, because this is such a fuss that, you know, if the Russian press secretary of Putin even denied the existence of this, then this has reached such a fuss on the internet and it's gained so much notoriety that they even have to admit that, you know, some Russian citizens died there. They will never tell you the full numbers or anything. That's out of the question, but the fact that they have been forced to even admit this is something huge. That is why I waited until they would do, because, you know, my own deadlines are coming closer. But I wanted to hear if the Russian government has anything to say about this, and Putin obviously hasn't, because since 7th he's been sick with flu, therefore doesn't give any comments. Which is strange, too. And we don't know what Rogozin will do, too. But yeah, these people will not have nice fates, those who survived. They will either get killed off or forgotten, but that, I think, is Putin's main problem now, because now you have a whole lot of them on hand, about 150, according to reports, but of them, obviously, many will die. But there will be no public mourning. There will be just governmental decisions on how to deal with your own guys who had went to do some really criminal and terrible things because of sheer desperation and poverty to serve personal interests of some really corrupt asshole. And now they've been blasted to hell and back, and Putin's elections are coming. And if this would come to light in Russia and cause even bigger fuss there when these people would come out, because, you know, their families are already posting on social media that, hey, this guy died there fighting in Syria at that point, it's coming out, but those articles also kind of get deleted. So that's the Putin's main problem for the following few days. But yeah, it's a shame about the guys, because even those who survived, they're not going to have happy fates now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So what does this whole thing mean for me, you, everyone listening, and the whole region and safety in general? Well, we all know that Russia will try to find an answer to this, because their government is kind of vengeful in this idea, and a lot of their military still follows the Soviet-era thinking that some revenge must be had. But I doubt that they'll seek a direct confrontation with NATO forces, or coalition forces, for that matter. For one, some commentators, such as Nevzorov, had stated that, you know, what's there to mourn? There were mercenaries, guys who went there to kill people for money. And he also alluded to the fact that the fighter bomber pilot, who was shot down in Syria previously, just a few days before the Russian one, that he was also going to just bomb civilians, because Russians are kind of famous for bombing civilians in Syria, and not ISIS at all, if you can look at the maps of their airstrikes. So, some people, like this Vadim Nevzorov says, that this response to this already had happened, that that Israeli plane that got shot down in the skies of Syria by Bashar Assad supporters, that it was the response To which, again, Israel responded by just blasting away anti-air capabilities of the Syrian government. But yeah, I think that any direct military conflict will be avoided. But we will certainly hear some very silly things from Mr. Zhirinovsky or some other people out there. Then it's gonna get a bit crazy. Like, for example, when recently Mr. Elon Musk, and congratulations to him for that, when he kind of launched his with his SpaceX program, the Falcon Heavy rocket. Then, just a few days later, the Ministry of Cosmic Affairs, because, you know, they're a cosmonautics ministry, they declared that they're going to launch a unique project that's going to be super special Russian project there, which will kind of serve as a public face, because, you know, Roscosmos lost a lot of face, and there were, like, when we were watching the launch, I watched it in Russian YouTube channels and Russian kind of media, and there were a lot of comments who were just kind of cheering for the explosion of the rocket, but, you know, it launched successfully as it does. And now their response is going to be that they're going to launch a chapel in space. So they're going to launch up a satellite, which is going to be, like, all the measurement instruments are going to be taken out, and that's going to be replaced with a small miniature chapel in space, with the icons, and, of course, some other computers there will be replaced with a reliquary. At the same time, this satellite shall be armed, and it will also be used besides this temple in space as a means to track down movements of ballistic missiles, and it will be equipped to shoot down other satellites. Now, for my few Orthodox listeners out there, I'm not really sure that you should have a temple, an Orthodox church, armed with lasers and missiles out in space. That is kind of silly, but that's kind of as people treat it on the Russian internet, the official response of the Russian government to Elon Musk. Because, you know, they have to respond. But in this case, I personally think that Putin is just ill and out there while they come up with something that they could do. Because obviously, well, this was the first case, as, again, military commentators from the Russian side are saying, when Russian army units, because that's exactly who these Wagner guys were, when the Russian army is fighting someone who's also capable of fighting back. Because, as the opposition journalist Sasha Sotnik says, the Russians are good when fighting against Georgians whose whole population is less than that of Moscow, and then they're fighting Ukrainians, who are also ill-equipped and under-equipped. And even though the Russian propaganda constantly states that they have the best tanks, their new tank Armata and everything, they still were panicking when they found out about the lethal weapons being given to Ukrainians, and then one has to wonder why. If these weapons can't do anything to mighty Russian tanks, and as previously, obviously, American missiles and anything, they couldn't harm Soviet vehicles. It's the same story, really, because it's the same generals. Then, you know, why are they so worried? Well, right now, the Russians decided to experiment a bit with assaulting a modern army, inspired by their own fake victories and everything, and that ended really terrible for them. And there is no way how the Putin's Kremlin government can turn this into a positive. But they're trying really, really hard, so we will soon see something silly out of them. On the bright side, this has lessened the chances of the Baltics getting invaded or anything of that sort. But it might cause some internal issues in Russia, because this ideal story about how, you know, army is invincible and how everything is smooth and based up on our military. The Soviet military culture is kinda close to the American one with the glorification of heroes, but unlike the Americans, they don't really care about their veterans or their dead or their wounded, for example. They care only about, you know, successes and great stories about how everything was great and will be great in the future. And this is a bit silly at this point. It is sad, and it is miserable, and now the Russians are panicking. They're definitely panicking. But this is, and I'm kind of wary to predict this situation, as Rogozhin himself is responsible for a lot of political murders inside Russia. And as he knows that he's the one responsible for this by Putin, there's also some theories going around that this might serve as a beginning of some sort of internal palace coup in Russia. Because, you know, as Putin is ill now, it is possible, might be possible to happen that he might not, after all, get elected on the 18th of March. Because, you know, what if we just put all the blame on Putin instead of, you know, all the elites who are tied into this corruption network completely, and, you know, put all the blame on Putin, get rid of Putin, and say to the world that, hey, we're clean and nice, and everything's great and shiny. That's, of course, just an opinion and a theory, but that might happen. It's a weird prediction there. In the end, the current situation is that they will still get a lot of reinforcements and so-called volunteers. Because, for one, in Russia, turns out that people are losing money en masse, as a few of their banks had gone down under, artificially imploded by people who were kind of losing, they lost their money who was in offshore, so they had to get some money back. So about a year ago, a couple of banks went under, kind of private-owned banks, who were, there's a lot of suspicion that FSB and other Russian state agencies were involved there with players. But there were people who just, you know, before the bankruptcy of these banks and the official declaration that they were closed, there were people who, you know, as usual, managed to take out money from the banks. But now, the Russian Agency of Protecting Investments is suing people in Russia en masse. About 150,000 people, common everyday people, have been sued so that they would return the money that they themselves, their own money, that they themselves had taken out of Russian banks. And it's all based because this agency declares that, hey, they all must have had some insider knowledge about that these banks are gonna get bankrupt, so they took their money out to preserve their money. Yeah, and the situation has gone so absurd that even anti-liberal, anti-West media are writing about this now. This is just too big because, for example, there were people who just got ill and who didn't know anything about it. Like, people, random people from the countryside, 150,000 people, common people, all had insider knowledge about what the central bank agency would do, even though the central bank itself took out insane amounts of money from these banks just 2 days before they were declared bankrupt. But Ms. Nabiullina, who runs the whole banking sector in Russian government, yeah, she doesn't declare that to be insider knowledge, but your random person kind of outside the inner circles, yeah, they are the true insiders. So what's going on now is that the Russian government just keeps taking money away from the people, which means that if Putin would want to kind of evolve into an even more aggressive thing and do something crazy again, then he would have a fresh, nice line of troops available to him, because people in desperation do such things. And this whole weird poverty in Russia, and I was intending this to be a whole different episode, especially in Siberian cities, like Vladivostok, like eastern part of Russia, which is kind of the far east part. There is a youth movement called AUYE. It comes from prison jargon and literally kind of means unity of the arrested and those sitting in prison. Because in Russia at this point, the kind of the kids in schools, they don't see any future for them. So people with contacts in Russian prison system just arrive in your school, find out who's the biggest bully, and then, you know, put their watch over him with the text of, hey, you know, if you bully around other kids in school and, you know, beat money out of them and then give half of that money to me, which to provide for the guys sitting in prison right now, then when you will finally get arrested, then, you know, you help out the zone and the zone will help out you further on. And it's quite a mass movement. They have been like a bunch of activities going on there. Now, why this happens? Because obviously, these guys are now raised in some prison slang, prison culture. They have gangs running schools, like teenagers beating up smaller kids and really giving this money thing. What little do they have, obviously. But the root of the problem is that in Russia, there are a lot of smaller cities and towns who are dependent on just one kind of a company, like one kind of business. As far as I know, something similar happened in Detroit with the car and steel industry, which went down, and in the Midwest, the coal industry or something like that. You know, there are towns who are dependent just on one type of industry. Meanwhile, in Russia, this whole situation about how these industries die off is a bit different than just, you know, technology marching forward. See, in this corporate mafia, the process works like this. Let's imagine this. You're a businessman. You have managed through the Soviet era to save up a factory that builds, say, I don't know, whatever, tractors. So you've saved up your tractor company, people have saved up their tractor company, this whole tractor company is where 60% of the town work or whatever. And then one day you get a call from the government, because someone has decided that they need to press off your company and get a bit more money. So, and this is also figurating in my interview with Mr. Dmitry Potapenko. Russia has about 70 non-tax kind of mandatory payments to the government by the companies. So, you know, you're running your tractor company, which is by now grown successful and provide money. But then you get you constantly start getting random checks. Up to, like, in one report, there was this company in Kuban who started getting 400 governmental checks per day, per year, sorry. 400 governmental checks per year. Basically, is the paperwork in order, everything. They just start to press down on these businesses to the point where they will find some regulations, some of insane amount of the regulations, insane amount of paperwork, whatever. Obscene amount of rules in Russia, and they will find or fabricate something that you've done wrong. Then they'll say, well, you know, we can put you in prison for this, or, you know, you can just resign, we will put this bankruptcy administrator on you, whatever, you know, just put one of our own kind of clerks in power of this company. Usually it ends up with these kind of bankruptcy administrators or whatever just forcing the businessman to hand over his business, his whole company, to the state clerks, who are all tied together in this whole gigantic mafia organization. So once that happens, these guys go to the governmental investment banks and basically mortgage every little tiny thing which they can, taking huge amounts of useless loans, which they themselves then pocket, you know, dealing out to their friends or whatever, family, whatever. They just pocket and steal all the money from these loans. The company runs on for a while, but then the guys who are their friends in the central bank, the state-owned bank, yeah, those guys then come over and decide that, hey, enough's enough, we also need to get some money, because, you know, budget money has been just stolen away by our officials. So they just go and basically sell off for scrap metal or whatever, they just sell off every property that this whole company had. Then they take the money and pocket it, you know, other people, so that other people can steal it. That is how the kind of the oligarchs in Russia make a lot of their money, just basically pressing off private businesses, mortgaging them to governmental banks who are run by their friends and their colleagues, and then they just basically and forcibly steal off your company using government as a means of extortion. And then obviously a lot of people just stay out of work. They stay out of work, they become, the poverty level increases, and, you know, people get poorer and poorer. From these people, this is where the so-called volunteers come from. Those are people who were just working in their factory, but the government officials decided that, hey, you know, we have sanctions now, and, you know, due to sanctions, some of our higher-ups have lost some money, which they want back, and if I'll help do this scheme, then I will be able to afford another yacht, and, you know, it's going to be great. I'll get my own odd-cut. This is where the volunteers come from. These Wagnerovtsi, these guys who do there. It's just that what's going on there is enforced impoverishing of their own people, and using then those impoverished people to commit some nice acts of aggression, like in Ukraine or Crimea, or as we saw here in Syria. And, you know, then Putin can declare another Russian victory, trademark. And it kind of plays in politically, because a lot of people still vote for him because, you know, obviously he's making the government great. But right now, what happened on the 7th, we saw that a government without economy and without modern technologies, who were all imported from the West, they cannot wage war now, and this might be the breaking point again with all this crazy situation here, that we might see some turnabout. Because at this point, everything that can be stolen is stolen, but it turns out it's just not enough to score another great victory. Things, in my opinion, are about to get interesting the closer the 18th of March comes. We're getting back to our regular history episodes, of course, and we'll be busy with those, but I hope you enjoyed it. Please, please write us an email, leave us a review on iTunes and other things, and do contact me, write us some emails, or on Facebook, or on Twitter, Eastern_border, or Facebook, just Eastern Border. Just write what you think about all this situation, because things are getting really interesting here, and can't say I'm a huge fan of interesting. Anyhow, let us know, and до свидания, товарищи.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Border. If you have any comments or specific details you'd like to know, you're welcome to leave it in the comment section on our site, theeasternborder.lv, and we'll rummage even to the western border to find you an answer. Like this podcast? Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or on our RSS feed. Happiness is mandatory. Good reviews and donations feed the farmers of our kolkhoz in the great motherland. The Eastern Border salutes you. This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org for more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.